Chapter 2. Alibis. A case that would have taxed the ingenuity of Sherlock Holmes took place in Montana in September 1901. The body of an old man named Dodson was found in his cabin near Helmsville with a bullet in the heart. On the opposite wall, a gun had been rigged up in a wooden frame with the muzzle pointing at the dead man. A string ran from the dead man's head through a metal ring in the wall to the trigger of the gun. It looked like a clear case of suicide. A note beside the body seemed to confirm this. It read, "It warn't my Clint done that Cullinan murder. Clint lied to save me. I done it." It was signed Oliver Dodson, and friends verified that it was in his handwriting. The Cullinan murder had taken place on August the 5th, 1899. A prospector named Jean Cullinan had been found shot dead in his cabin, not far from Dodson's place. A few days later, sheriff's officers arrested Clint Dodson and two other men named Oliver Benson and Ellis Persinger. Benson and Persinger admitted robbing Jean Cullinan, but alleged that it was Clint Dodson who had shot the prospector twice in the heart. Benson and Persinger were sentenced to 10 years in prison. Clint Dodson received life. Now it looked as if Dodson might have been innocent after all. He had what amounted to a double alibi. He was behind bars at the time of his father's death, so there could be no question that he might have forced his father to sign a false confession. Old man Dodson seemed to be offering his son a kind of posthumous alibi for the time of the murder. Under Sheriff John Robinson, the man who had sent Clint Dodson to jail, went to interview Persinger and Benson. Were they quite sure it was Clint who had killed the prospector? They insisted they were absolutely certain they had seen him do it. They left the under-sheriff with a strange problem. Why had the old man confessed to a crime he did not commit? He was certainly an alcoholic, but had never been weak in the head. He checked with the prison governor at Deer Lodge Jail, where Dodson was serving his sentence, and learned that one of Dodson's closest friends, a robber named Jim Fleming, had been released from prison only a few weeks earlier. Sheriff Robinson decided he had to talk to Fleming. But first, he adopted one of Sherlock Holmes' favourite expedients and put on the worst-fitting clothes he could find. Then he made his way to the distant ranch, 50 miles from Helena, where Fleming's girlfriend lived. He introduced himself as an ex-convict from Deer Lodge and explained that he was looking for his old friend Jim Fleming. The girl believed him. She told him that Fleming would be back in a few days and invited him to have a cup of coffee. They had a friendly talk, and soon she mentioned a matter of $50,000 that Clint Dodson had got when he robbed Union Pacific. It seemed that she was expecting a share of the money. This was what Sheriff Robinson wanted to know. Now he had his motive for the murder. He rode back to Helena and made intensive inquiries to find out if Jim Fleming had been seen with old man Dodson at any time. Soon he found what he wanted. Someone who had seen them together just before the old man's death. Robinson went back to the ranch, lay in wait for Jim Fleming, and arrested him. The sheriff had nothing to go on but guesses. He played his suspect as a skillful angler plays a big fish. He told him that he had been talking to Clint Dodson in jail. He spoke as if he knew all about the Union Pacific robbery. "Clint didn't do that, stick-up. He didn't have anything to do with it. There ain't no $50,000. And then he hinted casually that he knew Fleming had been drinking with old man Dodson just before his death. He knew because Clint had told him. Suddenly Fleming saw himself surrounded by pitfalls of treachery. So when Robinson said, "Would you like to make a statement?" Fleming said, "Yes, I sure would." The story he told revealed such incredible viciousness that even the veteran sheriff was shocked. Clint Dodson had deliberately planned the murder of his own father in order to clear himself of the murder of Jean Cullinan. With promises of a share of $50,000, he'd persuaded Fleming to go to the old man's cabin and to get him drunk. When the old man was drunk, it was easy to persuade him to do anything. That was how Fleming had got the note. The old man did it for a joke. Later, when Oliver Dodson was stupefied with the raw whiskey, Fleming shot him through the heart and rigged up the shotgun to make it look like an accident. Fleming was hanged on September the 6th, 1902, Dodson in April 1904. And the double alibi murder has come to rank as one of the strangest cases in modern criminal history. Yet, if you had asked Clint Dodson if he had an alibi for the murder of Jean Cullinan, he would not have known what you were talking about. It's only in recent years, since the rise of the detective story and the TV thriller, that the word has passed into the language. The Latin word, alibi, actually means elsewhere. So it's incorrect to say the prisoner has an alibi. It should be the prisoner was alibi. Oddly enough, it's only in the past 50 years or so that the criminal has given serious thought to the problem of alibis. In less sophisticated days, he committed his murder and then did his best to be elsewhere when the crime was discovered. The modern criminal has discovered the advantages of persuading the police that he was already alibi at the time the crime was committed. On the whole, most of these attempts have been fairly crude. In The Three Musketeers, D'Artagnan puts back the clock by half an hour and then draws the attention of his regimental commander to it, to establish that he could not possibly have been present at a certain fight. Real-life alibis have sometimes been as obvious and as absurd. George Joseph Smith, the Brides in the Bath murderer, moved into rooms in Highgate, London, on December the 17th, 1914, accompanied by his new wife, a clergyman's daughter named Margaret Lofty. The following day, the landlady heard sounds of splashing coming from the bathroom and hands slapping on the side of the bath. Then silence. This was broken by the sound of the organ being played in the sitting room. John Lloyd, alias George Smith, was establishing his alibi. A few minutes later, the front door slammed loudly, and then he came back, saying, "I've brought some tomatoes for Mrs. Lloyd's supper." At this point, the landlady noticed water leaking through the ceiling. Lloyd rushed upstairs, burst into the bathroom and shouted, "My wife can't speak to me! Go for a doctor!" Predictably, Mrs. Lloyd was drowned. But Smith might well have got away with it if a newspaper report of the death had not been seen by a relative of one of Smith's previous victims. And when George Smith finally appeared in court, and the story of that evening was told by the prosecutor, Sir Archibald Bodkin, the killer found out that a poor alibi is worse than no alibi at all. Far more brilliant and elaborate alibis than George Smith's have proved just as ineffective. The classic American case, with all those features so dear to the heart of the lover of detective stories, took place just 1 year after the execution of the Brides in the Bath killer. Frederick Small was an unsuccessful grocer of Portland, Maine, whose matrimonial affairs were pursued by misfortune. His first wife died in childbirth. His second ran off with the president of a baseball team. Small was granted $10,000 damages. In 1911, when he was approaching the age of 45, Small married a third time, Florence Arlene Curry, a girl nearly 15 years his junior. The marriage was not happy. Small seems to have been a coarse and bullying man who often beat his wife. In 1914, Small decided that it was time to retire. They moved to a cottage near Mountain View, New Hampshire. It was on the edge of Lake Ossipee, and Small spent much of his time fishing. The Smalls were not poor, but neither were they as well off as the husband thought they deserved to be. In early 1916, he insured his wife's life for $20,000, and his cottage for a further $3,000. The outlay, $1,000 or so, was large, for Small's total fortune was less than $5,000, but he had plans for recouping his losses. The man who had sold him the life insurance was Edwin Connor, who was also principal of the local school. Unlike most of the residents of Mountain View, Connor seemed to find Small pleasant enough, and Small went out of his way to be nice to Connor. They even agreed to take a trip to Boston together, partly to look into some further insurance business, but mainly for pleasure. On the morning of September the 28th, 1916, Small phoned his friend and asked him if he could make the Boston trip that day. Now, this was short notice. Connor said it would be difficult. Small insisted. And finally, Connor said that he would see what he could do. At 2 o'clock, a local wagon driver named Kennett was asked if he could collect Small at 3:30 in time for the 4 o'clock train to Boston. Kennett deliberately arrived early because on previous occasions, Small had invited him in for a tot of rye whiskey. But this time he found Small already waiting on the back porch. Small opened the door, shouted goodbye to his wife, and they drove off. The two men took the afternoon train, arriving in Boston at 8. There they checked into a hotel and went to see a play. Afterwards they ate supper and then returned to the hotel. The desk clerk was waiting with a message for Small. There had been a fire back at Mountain View, and he was to ring the local hotel. A few minutes later, a distraught Frederick Small asked Connor to take the phone and to confirm the message. His house was in flames, said the hotel keeper, and he had better hire a car and return immediately. Small's grief seemed enormous and genuine. Everyone was sympathetic. Back home, as the dawn was rising over the lake, Small viewed the smouldering ashes of his cottage. In a choking voice, he asked the local doctor if someone could search the ruins for his wife's body. An hour later, the doctor rang Small at the hotel. "We've found the body. What do you want us to do with it?" For a moment, Small was nonplussed. And then he asked, with amazement, "You mean there's enough to be buried?" There was indeed, for the body had collapsed through the floor of the sitting room into the basement, and there were several inches of water in the basement. Mrs. Small still had a cord knotted tightly around her throat. She had a bullet wound in the skull, and the head had been bludgeoned. Frederick Small was promptly placed under arrest. He insisted that his wife had been alive when he left the house, and he asked Mr. Kennett to verify that she had come to the back porch to say goodbye. The wagon driver replied that, as far as he could recollect, Small had called goodbye, but there had been no reply. The police found other evidence to indicate that the murder had been carefully planned. In the wreckage, there was an alarm clock with wires and spark plugs attached to it. There could be no doubt that it was a timing device. Small had been too clever. In order to make sure that his wife's body was completely consumed, he used a quantity of a substance known as thermite, a powder made of aluminium filings, metallic oxides and magnesium. It's used in welding because it produces such an intense heat. The heat was intended to incinerate Mrs. Small's corpse. Instead, it burned a hole in the floor, and the corpse fell into the water in the basement. The evidence suggests that Small killed his wife accidentally, or in a fit of rage. Various witnesses described his violent temper. It's just possible that he might have escaped the gallows with a plea of second-degree murder. As it was, he was hanged on January the 15th, 1918. It's an interesting question whether Small's ingenuity inspired another fire murder in 1933. On October the 25th of that year, Richard Budd, a middle-aged lumberjack of Eagle River, Wisconsin, arrived home from work at 6 in the evening and found the doors all locked. As he shouted his wife's name, neighbours came over to see what was the matter. They forced their way in and immediately smelled smoke. There had been a fire in the bedroom closet, a large wooden cupboard. It had burned through the floor, and the closet door had fallen through into the basement. So had the body of Virginia Budd, which had also been in the closet. This was a baffling problem for Sheriff Thomas McGregor. Why had Mrs. Budd shut herself in the closet and set fire to it? Or was it possible that she had been put in there and set alight? On the other hand, the key was still in the lock of the closet door, on the outside, and the door was unlocked. The theory of the coroner was that Mrs. Budd, who had recently been ill, had gone into the closet and committed suicide by setting herself on fire. Burning oneself to death is, oddly enough, a fairly common form of suicide. Budd had a watertight alibi. He had left for work at 8 in the morning. Neighbours not only heard him calling goodbye to his wife, but also something about bringing a loaf and some sausages home with him. The local fire chief estimated that the fire must have started at about 2 in the afternoon. If Budd had killed his wife, he must have returned home to do so. Well, that was just possible. He had worked alone in the woods. But a check on the amount of wood that he had chopped revealed that he had done an exceptionally hard day's work. There would have been no time to rush home and kill his wife, a process that would have taken 2 hours. Besides, the neighbours would almost certainly have seen him. The pathologist's report seemed to establish Budd's innocence beyond all doubt. Presence of smoke in the lungs proved that Mrs. Budd had been alive when she entered the closet. The fact that the door was unlocked seemed to clinch it. If she'd been alive and conscious, she would simply have walked out. The coroner's jury saw no reason to doubt Budd's innocence. His wife's death brought him no advantage. She had not been insured, and there was no rumour of another woman. It was true that the Budds often fought, but that was nothing unusual. A verdict of death through causes unknown was returned. At which point, as in the Small case, fate took a hand. The coroner, P.J. Gaffney, was sitting alone in his office after the inquest, with various items of evidence on his desk. Mrs. Budd's half-burned shoes, fragments of clothing, and the lock from the closet door. By some chance, the lock fell off the desk. Startled, Gaffney jumped up and picked it up. He noticed that the fall had made the lock spring out. He dropped it again. The lock went back. He tried it several times. Through some peculiar fault, each impact caused it either to lock or to unlock. He sat down again and began to think deeply. This didn't prove anything, of course, but if the closet door, complete with lock, had fallen through into the basement, shouldn't it have been locked when it was found? The fact that it was unlocked suggested that it had been locked before it fell. But if Budd had put his wife in the closet, how had he set fire to it 6 hours after he left for work? There was no evidence of a timing device. The coroner was a painstaking man. He bought wood and constructed a closet of exactly the same size and design as the one in which Mrs. Budd had died. He lined it with a flame-resistant material of the same kind that had lined Budd's closet. He allowed the same quarter-inch air gap at the bottom of the door. He filled it with old clothes, set them alight, and closed the door. The fire that began at 8 in the morning took more than 12 hours to burn through the floor. The fire chief had made a mistake. Richard Budd could have started the fire before he left for work. With this much evidence, Gaffney decided on an autopsy. It confirmed all his suspicions. Strychnine was found in Mrs. Budd's stomach. It had been a murder of atrocious cruelty. Budd had given his wife the poison, a large dose, enough to make her unconscious after considerable suffering. Then he had placed her in the cupboard and set fire to her, and then left her to suffocate. There was not enough of the body left to allow the coroner to estimate the time of death. Budd was tried, but there was one thing that the coroner had not been able to establish: a motive. The jury decided that Mrs. Budd could have taken the strychnine herself. They acquitted Budd, who proceeded to drink himself to death. A few months later, in a fit of delirium tremens, he also took poison in the bedroom where his wife had died. He left a note confessing to the murder. There were many people in Eagle River who said that it was his wife's ghost who drove him to kill himself. Gaffney was not entirely sceptical. He always claimed that the lock had been in the middle of his desk. In the long run, the most effective alibis are probably the simplest. Perhaps the most effective method of all is to get someone else to provide it, preferably a wife who can't give evidence against her husband in court. Raymond Morris, the English sex murderer, persuaded 7-year-old Christine Darby to get into his car on August the 19th, 1967. Her naked and misused body was found in nearby woods near Cannock Chase, Staffordshire. Morris was among those questioned by the police because his car fitted the description of the murderer's car. Morris's wife told the police that her husband had been at home at the time the murder was committed. She had no suspicion he was the killer. She only wanted to save him trouble. In the following year, Morris tried to drag a 10-year-old girl into his car. A woman noted the number, and he was arrested. His wife's well-meant loyalty almost led to another murder. This whole matter of alibis has undoubtedly been exaggerated by the rise of the detective story. Could you remember what you were doing on the evening of August the 10th last year? Of course not. Fortunately, most criminals are too stupid to realise that nothing makes a detective so suspicious as a watertight alibi.